Okay, we're going to be on our first docket, 88457, Clark County Department of Family Services. Before we get started, let me just inform everybody that Justice Bell wanted me to send her apologies. As you probably know, she's stationed in Carson City and is here every week, but unfortunately something came up that required her to travel back down to Las Vegas. She is going to be listening in, however. Depending upon how that hookup goes, I don't know if she'll ask questions or maybe text me about asking questions. So don't think badly of me if I look at my phone every so often. But she is participating and will be participating in our deliberations as well. And before we get started, does petitioner wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes.
Okay. As you know, the light will come on and the bell should come on, Julie, right at 5 minutes and then at three or just at three? It's just at three. Okay. Okay. Are you all ready to get started?
Yes, sir.
Yes? Okay, you can go ahead. Can't adjust that at all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Danilla Rowe. I am a Chief Deputy District Attorney with the Clark County District Attorney's Office, and I have the pleasure of representing the Department of Family Services. Your Honor, the department is thankful that you took the time today to hear this very important issue. The protection of reporting sources is essential to the department, not only the child welfare agencies here in Nevada, but across the nation. Reporting sources are our lifeblood. It's how we get the information to go out and investigate and protect children. If we cannot protect our reporting sources from being disclosed, they're not going to call. Right. It's going to have a chilling effect on child abuse and neglect.
How do we square the protection of the reporters with the due process rights of the defendant under Brady?
Well, Your Honor, under Brady, we are not the type of agency anticipated by Brady. We do not investigate for the criminal prosecutor. We are a statutorily created agency. We investigate abuse and neglect for the purpose of protecting children pursuant to a 432B or what we call a dependency case. So we're doing an independent investigation of our own. It can cross over a criminal investigation, but the department does not investigate for law enforcement. They do not investigate for the criminal case. Sometimes they just blend together.
But isn't the only showing that needs to be made is that the public disclosure of the information is necessary for the determination of the issue before the court under 432B-290, and the court below determined that there was a necessity for this information. So how do we overcome that? Why was that a manifest abuse of discretion?
Well, Your Honor, I think what's important is reporting sources are specifically dealt with under 432B.290, Section 4. Mm-hmm. And it states that outside of Section 6, which is a report made in bad faith that's unsubstantiated that they can go after, outside of that exception, we are tasked with keeping reporting sources confidential. We are tasked with protecting the identity and the safety of a reporting source. We can also protect others who give us information during a report if we believe that their safety is also at risk. But the underlying reporting source is protected.
Is there any evidence that the informant or the alleged victim would suffer harm if the unredacted report was produced?
Well, Your Honor, and that's under Section 4. It doesn't require that. We are just to protect the identity and safety of a reporting source. It doesn't say we have to find that they're in danger. We're to protect them outright. Any other persons we choose to protect, we have to protect.
That opinion that it doesn't involve harm to the investigation or harm to an individual under Section 4.
And, Your Honor, I think that's one of the issues that the defense and I had in this case, is if you read that section, it says that we are to do everything in our power to protect the identity and safety of the reporting source.
Okay.
And then it goes on, and any other person in which it could harm the investigation or that we find materially could affect their safety or harm. It's separate. The reporting source is always protected, but we can protect others. And that's the point. That second section is others. So let's say an aunt gives us information during the investigation, the father's violent, we feel that she may be at risk of harm, we could also protect her.
So how, if we were to read it the way you wish us to, how would in that second section, the language that says disclosure would cause a specific harm to an investigation, how does that protect a person?
It can. We can also protect an investigation, not just a person.
So hold on. So you think that section has three parts now?
I think it has two. I think it's hard to understand what they meant by that. I think they were trying to expand what we could protect, and it's not exactly well worded with regard to the other persons. But I think it also could, you could read it as if it was going to, if we were going to disclose any information regarding that person, it could harm the investigation. Not necessarily, that's outside of the reporting source. So it could be a second person that's given us information that we're using as part of the investigation, that letting people know that person's helping us could also harm the investigation, but they weren't the original reporting source.
But under your reading, it would be per se that you could never disclose the names of the reporters under that first section.
Outside of subsection 6, correct.
Okay. So that you should never have to provide a unredacted copy to a court?
Correct, Your Honor. That's why we're here.
Well, but a moment ago you said, look, the agency isn't involved in investigation. We just take in information, and generally law enforcement is doing the investigation. DA's office is doing the prosecution, yeah?
Right.
So doesn't it seem like the court should kind of be the gatekeeper of that? Not a per se, never can you be made to give an unredacted copy, because the earlier section of the statute talks about the court, if it needs to decide an issue in front of it, public information becomes an option, or publicly disclosing the information becomes an option.
Correct. And we can give information. We redact information that, according to Section 7 of 290, we have to take out confidential information, but we do provide information to the court for their in-camera inspection. It does not, based on Section 4, include the reporting source. We do not disclose that.
But just kind of from a 30,000-foot view, doesn't it seem like a per se rule against the disclosure of information as part of discovery would kind of be a bad idea without the court involved as a gatekeeper as to whether that information was relevant to protect constitutional rights or not?
And, Your Honor, it's the way it was written. Reporting sources are protected not only here but in every state. It's the one thing that we protect above all else is reporting sources and children. Because Vegas is a large town, but it's also a small town. It will get around that you're no longer protected when you call this in. People are going to stop calling. I've done this for over 20 years. The most significant case to me was an Uber Eats driver. The child was no longer in school. He was the only person that saw this child, and if he had not reported, I don't think that child would be with us today. Well, so it's important to protect them. They don't want to be involved. They don't want to do anything, but we need them to make that call.
Let's move on from that. What is it? Let's assume that you're wrong about the interpretation of Section 4 and that the harm to investigation or alleged harm to the life or safety of a person applies to the whole section. What, if any, evidence was provided to the court of those things?
With regard to these four four reports that they're talking about, yep, they were uninvestigated by us, Your Honor. We didn't verify the information. We didn't investigate it. We took the information. We wrote it down. It didn't rise to the level of investigation. We didn't do anything.
All right. So you would concede that there wasn't anything presented to the district court that would justify the court saying, hey, there's material harm to the investigation possible, or there's possible harm to a person.
Right.
Okay.
But, Your Honor, I go back to protecting reporting sources above all else. And that's the other thing. If you read Section 4, we're to protect the identity and safety of a reporting source and any other person. Then again, it says safety at the end. That's because they're separate. The any other person is a separate section. It's any other person that could have, during an investigation, and given us information that disclosing them could either place them, it could infect our investigation, or could place them at risk of harm. That's the whole point. Because if you read the five sections that do have the reporting source that we can't disclose, it doesn't say anything about their safety. It just says we're not to disclose the identity of a reporting source. So when they enacted Section 4, now all of a sudden they're like, we're going to fix this. We're going to make it global. We're going to make it all over everything. Because here's the key thing. Four of the five sections that we talk about that have that specific clause were enacted in 2011. One of them was already enacted prior to that. That was 2011. Section 4 came around in 2013. And it specifically starts out with, except Section 6, this applies to all of it. So we know that it applies to every section. The legislature just did not remove the reporting source from the other five, which I believe is I, J, Q, R, and U. They didn't remove it from those sections. They just created a global catch-all. This covers everything about reporting sources and not disclosing that. So they did that. And I'm hoping that we can get them to clarify that a little bit more. But I think that's the key. You're to protect the identity and safety of a reporting source and any other person. And that's where it kind of goes off into the any other person, and the investigation and the material harm applies to any other person, because the reporting source is the vital part. They just gave us the authority to protect others that could also be at harm. So, Your Honor, we would ask that you read the statute as we have interpreted it, as every state in the nation protects reporting sources from disclosure. Because if they won't report, we can't investigate. We are not Metro. We do not have boots on the ground out there investigating like that. It doesn't happen in plain sight. We need people to tell us which children are in danger so that we can do an investigation. And that's what's vital here.
So what about public policy arguments? You know, if we assume that you have a reasonable interpretation of Section 4, that it's divided up somehow, and there's a reasonable argument that it's not divided up, so that you know, at the end of the day, you have to say it's probably ambiguous. The legislature didn't really weigh in too heavily on wording it in a way that gives us confidence in what it means. And the legislature didn't really speak to what its intent was, doesn't really appear in the legislative history. From a public policy argument, how do we weigh that in favor of your interpretation versus one that would allow potentially for the court to be involved in making the decision?
I don't know how we'd ratify that, Judge. I don't. It's one of those where, like in this case, you've got four uninvestigated reports with no connection to the defendant whatsoever. Three of them are abuse of the victim by her mother that were information only, because I believe the abuse happened in California. I mean, they have nothing to do with that case. And like you said, under Section 2E, we release to the court as our gatekeeper to take a look in camera to see what's relevant and what needs to be disclosed. How the victim being physically abused by her mother that wasn't investigated by our agency, we don't know how that was relevant to a criminal case for sexual assault when none of these reports had anything to do with the defendant. But, Your Honor, I think, I'll save the rest.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Counsel, Justice Herndon, Justice Lee, Justice Bell, I know you're there somewhere.
In the ether.
My name is Christy Holston. I represent Nico Sharp, who is the respondent. May it please the court. This case explores the balance between two important public policies to protect innocence. We want to protect innocent children, but we also want to protect innocent men and women from being wrongfully convicted of a crime they didn't commit. In order to protect innocent children, we make certain records confidential from general public dissemination. And in order to protect innocent people from wrongful convictions, we provide for criminal discovery and we provide evidence to criminal defendants. This balance between these two public policies has already been appropriately struck by the Nevada legislature, by this court and by the United States Supreme Court. And that's because CPS records, by statute, are kept mostly confidential, and we provide discovery to criminal defendants. It is not prohibited for them to get this confidential information about CPS records. In fact, it is required to be disclosed to criminal defendants.
But counsel, I'm looking at the statute 432B294, and let's say that I think that it is a little ambiguous, but if you look at the first part that's separated by the word and, doesn't that and suggest that there are two different parts to subsection 4? One, mandatory reporters are absolutely protected in terms of their identity, and you can also take whatever actions you need to protect any other person if DFS reasonably believes that disclosure of the information would cause a specific and material harm. So why should that all be read together when the word and seems to separate it into two separate parts?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's not ambiguous because I think the word and is conjunctive that joins together any person who reports with any other person. So you could read it as DFS must protect both any person who reports and any other person. And then the if introduces a condition precedent. And that condition precedent applies to both the subjects identified above, any person and any person who reports.
But don't you think that it could reasonably be read either way, thus the ambiguity?
I don't think it's ambiguous, Your Honor, and that's because there's no punctuation, there's no word, there's no phrase, there's no grammar device that would indicate that the two groups or the two subjects, any person and any person who reports, are part of independent sections with different rules or different conditions precedent.
And what about the argument made by counsel that the identity of reporters is consistent throughout all of our states?
I did not research all of the states and their requirements as to the identity of reporting sources. But what I can tell you is another reason we know that Section 4 cannot possibly be a prohibition on ever identifying the reporting source is because it would render language in the other part of that statute ambiguous. So in Section 2, it identifies 29 different groups that get access to confidential CPS information. But for 5 of those groups, it specifically says the reporting source can never be identified. Now, if Section 4 said the reporting source can never be identified under any circumstances, it would render the language in those 5 subsections superfluous, and they would have absolutely no meaning. And so that's another reason, in addition to the plain language of Section 4, that's another way we know that this statute does not intend to create a complete prohibition on disclosing the identifying source.
So then if we move past that and we look at the necessity for this information, how do we balance that with the need to protect reporters? Because I think you would agree that that's an important protection to have. But how do we square that with the due process issues that are before us?
I think as it is an important public policy to protect the identity of the reporting sources, and luckily Section 4 creates a fail-safe, right? It creates a two-part test that says you can't reveal the identity of the source and you have to protect any person if there could be a harm either to the investigation or to the life or safety of any person. So in subsection 4, that's how we know it protects a potential investigation or the life and safety of any person. It creates that fail-safe. And then moving on to balancing that with the due process rights of the criminal defendant, that's where you know, we know that the law establishes a lot of important protections of confidential information. For example, the identity of confidential informants is protected. The President of the United States is granted executive privilege to perform his duties. Child pornography is protected from being disseminated. But in each of these circumstances, due process interests of a criminal defendant override those confidentialities and protections because it is important that a criminal defendant has evidence to protect against wrongful convictions. And another important thing I want to talk about in this case is who actually has possession of this information and who can disseminate it to a criminal defendant. Because I believe that NRS 432B290 and NRS 432B280 both say that prosecutors and police officers have access to this confidential CPS information, and then they can disseminate the information if it is pursuant to a criminal prosecution related to the abuse or neglect of a child. And so I would argue that the police and the prosecutors have a duty to disseminate these records to a criminal defendant under their statutory obligations for discovery and also under their due process obligations.
Well, under the department's reading of the statute, however, the dissemination of the information under all those exceptions and to all those entities, law enforcement, DA's office, et cetera, is subject to Section 4, which says before you release it, it's got to be redacted to protect the confidentiality. So arguably, whatever the DA receives should be redacted in that regard as well.
I agree, Judge, that that is...
I'd say it always happens, at least not in my experience, but...
Agreed. And in this case, we can see that it didn't happen that way. There is an inconsistency which with the way that they do that. But I agree, Justice Herndon, that that is their reading of the statute. My reading of the statute is different. My reading of the statute is that, and that's under NRS 432B 290, that unredacted information can be disseminated to the police and to the prosecutors.
Separate from Section 4.
And then it can only be redacted under Section 4 if the department determines that releasing the information would cause a harm either to an investigation or to the life and safety of any person.
Okay.
That's where the fail-safe comes in. But I think as this court was pointing out in their questioning, first, I think the department would have to make a showing. We're redacting this information because we identify that there is a harm to an investigation or the life and safety of a person. And I think they would have to meet those tests before they could redact the information.
So if we get to that point and then we look at what you're actually seeking to have unredacted, how are these reports germane to your client's defense? As counsel pointed out, the first four reports are about the alleged victim and abuse by her mother. How is the identity of the reporter or even the contents of those reports relevant to your client's defense?
First, I'll speak to the contents of the reports, Justice Lee, and then I will speak to why we need the reporting source. So as to the contents of the reports, the district court below has already determined that they are favorable and material to the defense, and there's a few reasons for that. This is a case involving allegations of sexual abuse of a child. The only evidence that will be presented at trial of the abuse will be the child's own statements. There will be no corroborating evidence presented. Therefore, the child's credibility will be the central issue to this case. And so anything that speaks to the child's credibility will be material to this case because any motive that she would have to fabricate is material in this case. And so for these reports, the most important report specifically shows that this child had experience making up sexual stories, making up stories about sex. But most importantly, it shows that this child denied that she had ever been sexually abused. Just to make sure we have the timeline correct, her contact with Mr. Sharp was in 2017. She was found making up sexual stories online in 2019. They asked her, hey, has anybody been abusing you or has anybody abused you ever? She said no. So that's a direct denial of the accusation that she later made that Mr. Sharp had been abusing her. So it's incredibly favorable to the defense. It really doesn't get more exculpatory than that. And so we don't know who was present during that conversation. We need the reporting source to ask who was present during the conversation, what else was said. There are some follow-up questions about information that was revealed during that conversation that we want more information about. For example, why does the family think that the step-uncle might have been sexually abusing her or that the grandfather might have been sexually abusing her? These could be alternative suspects in our case. And then also, we would need the reporting source to be able to present this evidence at trial. We couldn't just introduce these records to the jury without a witness for their admission. We have no idea who we could call to admit these records without knowing who was present in the room, so we need the reporting source so we can get to all that information. And then specifically regarding the three CPS reports that related to the abuse of ES by her mother, again, that information is going to be material and relevant because it speaks to her motive to fabricate. In these child sex abuse cases, a child's motive to fabricate frequently revolves around their family circumstances, their family relationships, their living situations. And so the defense has one particular theory that revolves around her motive to fabricate based on her mother's abuse of her. Again, we need more information. We need to be able to investigate. We can only do that by calling the reporting source. And we would need to be able to get this evidence into trial. And so we need the reporting source to know which witness we could call. And so, Your Honor, I think the final point that I want to make is we have two avenues to get at this information under the law. We can get it from the court if it goes through an in-camera inspection, but we can also get it through the prosecutors and the police because the law grants them access, and then the law says they can disseminate those records pursuant to a criminal prosecution. And they have a duty to do that under Nevada statute, but also under their Brady obligations. And so that's why it's important that this court find that the criminal prosecuting deputy has possession of these records, because that's how we get to a due process and a Brady analysis, right? Due process requires the government to turn over evidence that's in its possession, that's favorable to the defense, and that's material to guilt or punishment. We already know these records are favorable to the defense and they're material to guilt or punishment, but are they in the possession of the criminal prosecutor? The answer is yes, for a few reasons. One, because CPS does investigate along with the police, they assist in their investigation, and they conduct investigation on behalf of the police. We know that for two reasons. One, because in this case, we can see that CPS did conduct investigation on behalf of the police. In fact, CPS conducted the majority of the investigation on behalf of the police. But also, in NRS 32B, in that chapter, it says, and I'm quoting right now NRS 432B 180, it says, the Division of Child and Family Services shall coordinate its activities with and assist the efforts of any law enforcement agency. I'm quoting another section, NRS 432B 260. An agency which provides child welfare services and a law enforcement agency shall cooperate in the investigation, if any, of a report of abuse or neglect of a child. CPS frequently works with the police and on behalf of the police to conduct these investigations.
But you would agree that the petition that's filed by the state is challenging the district court's order to release unredacted records. It's not a challenge to the DA's office violating Brady or any other discovery obligations.
That's correct, Justice Herndon, but they do make the point in their brief that the criminal prosecutor does not have possession of this information and therefore cannot be violating Brady by refusing to turn it over. That's where we disagree. I see that my time has expired, so unless the court has any further questions, I will yield the podium.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello again. Okay. So, investigating for the police.
Records are turned over to criminal district attorneys and law enforcement. They are redacted exactly the same way as when they are handed over to the court. They do not get reportings.
Could you address counsel's interpretation of subsection 4 within the context of subsection 2, identifying the 29 groups, and that the five subsections that explicitly omit reporting sources, and then reading that in context with subsection 4, and the argument that that would, if we were to read it your way, it would render those other provisions meaningless?
Well, Your Honor, like I previously stated, those five sections were there, enacted in 2011. One was enacted prior to that. Section 4 came around in 2013. They just didn't remove the five sections where they should have when they enacted the global Section 4. So at this point, they are useless because 4 covers them all. It added it to everything.
Well, but we have to assume the legislature acted with intent, that there was a reason they wanted to leave in all of those sections and not just create some catch-all that vitiated the need for anything else but not do anything about it.
Right. But Section 4 specifically says, except for Section 6, this applies to this section. So Section 290, so it covers everything.
Let me go back to something you said in your original argument about every state recognizes the confidentiality of reporting, and I don't quarrel with that. But even the case that you cited in your petition, Ritchie, the U.S. Supreme Court case that talked about the need for the confidentiality and the fear of the chilling effect, acknowledged in its holding that it's not absolute, that the court can still be involved and, if circumstances dictate, release information in a case-by-case analysis.
Right, and that would be under 290, Section 2E. They can get the records. I mean, the reports they're talking about, they have the reports. They're redacted, and they don't include the reporting source, but they have the information because it went to the court first for the in-camera inspection and then was released.
But what I'm getting at is I don't know that the Ritchie case drew any line between redacted or unredacted. It just said this information is confidential and we want reporters to be able to go to the CYS counselors and understand that they're talking in confidence. But later on they said we're not under the belief that this is absolute, right? If in an appropriate circumstance a court determines that disclosure is appropriate, then it can disclose.
Right.
Ritchie was a Pennsylvania case, so it wasn't dealing with our statute.
Right. It had a Pennsylvania statute, correct. The biggest thing,
Please go ahead.
The biggest thing there, Your Honor, is they didn't even release the records. They allowed an in-camera inspection of the records.
Right.
But they do talk about protecting neighbors, relatives, things like that. They're talking about reporting sources that aren't going to want to disclose if they're going to be turned over. So it briefly touches on that, but it wasn't their main focus. Their main focus was the records themselves. And, Your Honor, I would argue that our statute creates as close to an absolute privilege as you can get, because only Section 6. 6 is the only way around it. And 6 is narrowly tailored and extremely specific. You have to be the subject of the report, it has to be unsubstantiated, and you have to show the district court it was made in bad faith or malicious for them to be able to turn it over to you, to be able to use it in a civil litigation. It's protecting those people that are constantly being reported on in bad faith, giving them something to go and challenge and go and stop that. That's the only exception, is we do not protect the person who does this in bad faith, but we protect everyone else.
But if the statute is ambiguous in all of our readings of it, how do you harmonize your version with the Constitution? Because we have to harmonize statutes with the Constitution.
Correct. And, Your Honor, that's a hard one to answer, but I think that our interpretation is correct. I think the "and," as Justice Bell said, is going to be the separator. There are two separate divisions here. And, again, if you look at it, identity and safety of reporting source, why would they say safety again at the end if they were talking about the reporting source? These are two separate sections. And I'm hoping the legislature will take a look at it again and put a period after reporting source and then add in the second section.
I hear they're going to meet again pretty quick, so maybe somebody wants to talk about it.
You might see me up there because we might be fixing this at that point. But I thank you for your time.
All right.